Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Scumbags, this is the Scummy Mummies podcast with your hosts Ellie Gibson and Helen Thorne.
Hello and welcome to the Scummy Mummies podcast. It's me, Ellie Gibson,
and it's me, Helen Thorne,
and it's you, Tracy Fox. Hello, Tracy.
Oh, hi.
Welcome. Hi. Welcome. Thank you for coming along. We're very pleased to have you with us, Tracy. Could you, for the listener, explain who you are, Tracy Fox? Who are you?
I am here because of one of my roles as a business faculty for the School of Life. Mm. So I teach emotional intelligence workshops in business for the School of Life. Beyond that, I'm many things. I'm a mediator. I am a facilitator. I'm an executive coach.
She's basically changing lives, Ellie. I was going to say something very rude. I was like, how shocking. I was going to say, you've been fixing men. Because when you say these things, I think, fuck, you're fixing men.
It's true to an extent. Because yeah. when I teach on the on conflict management skills courses and when I teach mediators, it is often the men who seem to have a light bulb switched on when I talk about listening.
Is it?
And managing emotions, and you know, sometimes they can't get it, and I don't want to be, you know, gender biased here, but it is often the men
you're
who
welcome
will say,
to do much of that.
And there was once a course where a gentleman went home after the first day, came back the second day, and we'd been teaching active listening on the previous day, and he said, you know what, when I went home yesterday evening, my wife turned around and said to me, oh, you know, are you having an affair? And I said, no, why? And she said, you actually really seem to be listening to me and paying attention to what I'm saying. What is going on? It's very unusual.
Ah.
And it's because it's so, for some, very revolutionary to think about how to have these skills to manage difficult conversations and understand people better.
Well, who knew? Because, I mean, your husband had an affair. He didn't bloody listen to you, though, did he?
No! I had no idea.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
That's brilliant. And that, I mean, what high job satisfaction you must have, because you were saying just before we started recording that you were into solutions. So you've got like a proper task and finish kind of job. It's not sort of, you can see the changes in people. And that must be pretty satisfying.
I often can see the changes.
They want to change.
Yeah, if they want to change, yeah. Right? And sometimes people just aren't ready to change. You know, it's very difficult to change your habits. Mm. We know that, right? We want to change our habits ourselves. We can't do it ourselves. And sometimes people are not quite ready. So if they're not ready to change in some ways, then it's more examining why they want to change. When I mediate, it's very solution focused. Mm. If they want to resolve the dispute, and mediation as a process, it works incredibly well. About 80% of cases that are mediated throughout, you know, with the company that I mediate for, CEDA, across the whole board of different kinds of disputes, whether it's clinical negligence or a funeral case or a commercial contract that's gone wrong, 80% of those cases settle on the day or shortly after.
Mm.
I had a case the week before last. It was about the claimant was a young woman who was in dispute with a cosmetic surgery organisation because she wanted to have a boob job. And I don't know why I do that when I do that.
But no, she's touching her breasts.
We're all touching our breasts.
She wanted to have a boob job, but unfortunately, because of her her medical history and I suppose her mental health history, they refused to do it. They said she had to wait for 6 months. And so she was very aggrieved by this. She was in a dispute with them, which kind of escalated as these things do. But yes, we were able to come together and we had 3 hours together and find a resolution. So brought that to
what was the resolution, Tracy?
I can't tell you what it is.
Oh, I want to know. I want to know if she's, you know, poking people's eyes out or just... Yeah, well, we have an ongoing business dispute, actually, about how much milk to put in tea, Tracy. Do you think you can mediate that for us?
Well, I'd like to know more about it, I suppose.
Helen puts too much milk in tea. I mean, that's what more do you need to know?
I would say Ellie puts too little. Okay. So there you go.
So what is it... why do you say it's too much? Or what is it about the quantity that's important?
I like a milky tea. Also, I don't like a hot drink. So I use milk as a coolant,
right?
Basically. So the and then I can drink it and then I justify it and say I need the calcium.
Whereas I'm like, well, just have a fucking cup of milk then. Just drink some milk.
I like milk.
I like tea to taste of tea, Tracy. Yeah. I don't want a tea milkshake.
Mm.
That's not in my interest.
But it sounds like you have different cups of tea, right? You don't share the same cup.
No.
It
somehow offends her. I don't care what colour her tea is. She gets offended.
It's the colour as well. Yeah. Then. So it's the temperature and the colour.
Yeah.
It's difficult, isn't it?
I think, you know. Well, I think we're in the 20% that's not going to get resolved today, Tracy.
No,
I think that's
nobody's right. Nobody's wrong.
Well, but anyway. But let's go back then, because we're here today really to talk about The School of Life and this book, The Good Enough Parent, which Helen and I have read. And I'll be honest with you, we don't read a lot of parenting books, to be honest. We're quite lazy. We're not very interested in it. But we've both read this one and it's brilliant. But I know The School of Life is sort of a complicated story. So what is The School of Life, really? Let's start with that.
So The School of Life is a global organisation really devoted to helping people live more fulfilled lives. And they do this by touching on the big themes of life, whether it's the self or love or relationships. And we're kind of headquartered in London in the UK,
mm-hmm.
but we have offices all over the world and workshops and classes. And the School of Life will offer have lots of literature like this, you know, books. There's masses and masses of online content focused on emotional well-being. We run lots of workshops and classes which I'm involved in, so I'm one of the business faculty and I often teach one of 20 emotional intelligence workshops, whether that be how to be resilient or effective, confident, how to be supportive or compassionate, how to be decisive, for instance. And also run lots of kind of events, so opportunities for people to meet each other and get together and yeah, just develop more self-awareness.
Because I feel like it's come... How long has it been going for, The School of Life? A few years now, hasn't it?
Many years. Many years, yeah.
And is it Alain de Botton? Did he set it up?
That's right, he's the founder. That's right, yes. Mm. Yeah. So much of the... what you hear and what you learn comes from Alain, really. I mean, he's very, incredibly perceptive and witty and funny, and makes things digestible as well.
Mm.
So one of the things that the School of Life does that's very unusual is it draws from some of the great ideas from culture and literature, the arts, or
philosophy. Oh, exactly. He's always going on about Dionysus. I've noticed that in this book. Just tell me whether to give them an iPad. How many hours a day to give them an iPad, Alan? I don't want to hear about Dionysus. Come on.
And then we kind of find the key liberating and transformative ideas from a particular discipline and apply it to everyday life. And that's because at the School of Life, we believe that knowing how to live is something that can be learned. So we teach you things that you probably wish, well, I often wish, why on earth didn't I learn this when I was younger or in school?
Mm.
And so it's a continuous learning process, really. That's what we do.
And do you think, we've all gone through a bit of dark times in the pandemic, and I think we've had a lot of time to kind of think about who we are and what we want and what we really don't want.
Do you tea. We think a lot about that, don't we? How much milk we want in our
apparently
tea.
Have you seen a bit of an increase in courses and people wanting to kind of dig a little deeper and know more about themselves because of that? Or do you think we're all just... still under our duvets and feeling a bit blue.
Well, I think I personally have said, well, I agree with you personally with regards to the need to understand ourselves better. Mm. I mean, let's face it, we've all been alone with ourselves in a way that we haven't been before. And although there are some people who like to, you know, kind of introspect and think about what they do and why they do it and how they do it. Mm. Many of us are so busy with our lives and it's outward facing, focused on outcomes and doing, that when the lockdown hit, it was a real shock to the system. And we did learn about ourselves, maybe in ways that we weren't particularly happy about. We learned about our habits or our lack of discipline or our lack of focus, or who we are. So I think that process, if it hadn't started for others, it certainly started then. And I think with many people have become more in touch with themselves, become more human, and they want to retain that. Actually, we want to be more of who we are rather than just being what our vocation is or what our job is. We want to learn more about being the best, a better version of ourselves. So yes, so the School of Life helps people to think about who they are, why they do what they do, and how they can be more fulfilled in their everyday lives.
But that better versus best thing, I think, is an important distinction, isn't it? And that's one of the things that first attracted me to this book, is the title. The fact it's called The Good Enough Parent. So immediately we're saying there is no such thing as a perfect parent. And children are not, I mean, we've talked to Philippa Perry about this, but children are not projects to be failed or you know, get an A star on or whatever. Yeah. I mean, that's a good place to start from, isn't it?
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, the term good enough, it came, it was derived from the British psychoanalyst Donald Winnicott back in the 1950s. He was a therapist that specialised in working with parents and on relationships. And he was really disturbed by how often the parents were coming into his consulting rooms and they were feeling really ashamed of themselves, or they were, you know, deeply aggrieved and depressed and anxious because they felt that they were failing as parents because maybe their children weren't getting the best grades, or they weren't, you know, their manners were not as perfect as they would like them to be, you know, that they didn't have perfect children. Mm. And the parents felt, you know, what is going on here? You know, we are failing. And Donald Winnicott said, actually, there is no such thing as a perfect parent. And even if there was, children do not need a perfect parent. Mm. What a child needs is a parent who prepares them effectively for an imperfect world, really. So a child needs a parent who is kind and considered but flawed and imperfect as well, to and essentially a parent that is good enough. So good enough isn't saying, you know, or the starting point isn't from the bottom, you know, I'll just do the bare minimum and kind of throw you scraps or whatever and you can rear yourself. It's coming from, you don't have to be perfect, let's pull that right down to what is more realistic for yourself as a parent, and also what the child needs to grow up to be contented and happy.
And actually, I think it says in the book, if you act like your parent, if you present to your child this image of this perfect person who never gets angry and is everything is perfect and everything's fine, you're doing your child a disservice because you're creating an impossible standard them to live up
to. That's right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's when I read the book, and when you're saying that, I think it kind of resonated with you as well, my fellow Libra. But when I read,
we found out before the podcast, everyone.
Let's pause things. Let's get to the real stuff.
Tracy and I have got the same birthday. So exciting.
Such a joy.
Yes, us and Stefan Dennis, 12th of October.
Yeah.
If he's listening, happy birthday to us, Stefan.
Yeah.
You were saying.
So you were saying that the way in which, you know, we shouldn't, children don't need a parent who is perfect because it's, you know, preparing them for an unrealistic world. When I read the book, it kind of, and I don't read lots of parenting books either. I mean, my kids are 12 and 16 now. But when I read the book, it kind of felt like a bit of a warm blanket being wrapped around me saying, actually, it's okay. What you're doing is fine. But I was reading it from the perspective as a parent, but also from when I was parented. So it made me think about my own experiences and how my parents treated me. So it's that constantly thinking about, well, what did I get? Now what do I do? But just very reassuring that we just have to be, it's important to be real. Because, you know, children, they watch our every move, don't they? You know, unfortunately, you know, they kind
too
of
much,
we're under the microscope and they pay attention to everything. And if they think that that we are perfect, then that puts huge unnecessary pressures on them. But for us to be able to say, you know, sorry, made a mistake, or I'm having a bad day today, mummy's feeling sad, or this is going well, or that's not going well, that helps them to navigate their own emotional intelligence and begin to understand, you know, that the highs and lows, or the variety of the emotions and the variety of experiences that we have in life. So yeah, I think I'm a huge fan of the book. Huge fan.
Yeah, well, I liked, and like Ellie and I were talking about this a couple of weeks ago, is there's a chapter, the way that it's presented, actually, because if we go through the chapters, it's like on soothing and listening and melancholy, naughtiness, you know, confidence, all sorts of things. But what I really liked was the chapter on melancholy, because I think this is the pressure that we have, and we presented it in social media. We've had the best day, we've had the happiest day, these are happy kids, all this sort of thing. We have this sort of unrealistic expectation about making this life for our children. And I know, after I got separated, that was my focus. I was like, something really sad has happened and it's out of all our control. We're going to have the happiest life. And, you know, we probably had too many biscuits, had too many movies. But I was like, no, we've got to be happy. And I just remembered thinking, I can't. That's an impossible task for me, and it's also pressure on them, because if I'm always saying we've got to be happy, then when they're feeling sad, they might feel like they're wrong. And so that's why I really loved about that particular section of the book, because everyone's going to have happy and sad days. And now I'm like, yeah, it's okay to feel sad, and we're going to have a sad day, and I have sad days as well. Like, my grief and my recovery from divorce is not linear, and it's not happy all the time. And yeah, that's what I thought was really useful, because I think we as a society are quite afraid of sadness, or don't have the language to talk about sadness.
I like this bit where it says, every life, even a good one, is filled with challenges that warrant regret, anxiety, grief and feelings of loss. Sadness is not an anomaly, it is an apt and appropriate response to tragedy of being alive. One should not have to worry that someone is sad. One would need to be alarmed if they didn't know how to be sad.
Absolutely.
Sometimes.
It's good.
And then there's a bit at the end about if we find a child in their room and in tears, and we it's not an insult or a sign we've failed, it's a sign that we've been brave enough to allow them to understand life on their own terms.
Oh, Tracy, you are good enough, Ellie.
I know.
But yeah, that's
powerful,
very comforting,
words, right?
Isn't it?
Powerful words. And these are words that I had never considered myself, you know, but when you read those words, it really resonates. You know, for me, I think it's important for people to live a full life, right? And a full life means a variety and depth of emotion, you know, going through difficult times and challenging times. That's where most growth happens. That's the reality of it, right? You know, and there's a phrase that I really like, and it says something like, you know, when you hit dark times, when you hit dark times, it's because you're when you reach a really low point, it's because you're supposed to find something down there, right?
Yeah.
And it leads to growth. And so without allowing your child, without allowing us as individuals to be in that space where we are having a challenging hard times, then, you know, there isn't any growth. And it's not, you're right, it's not realistic for people to be happy all the time. Even if, you know, even if you have everything that you want materially, or even, you know, relationship wise, you can still be sad or have dark times, and that's absolutely normal. It's funny, because when I think about my own experiences, I think, you know, I had a relatively happy childhood. I didn't really think I'd had too many challenges or difficulties. And I often used to think, you know, where has my learning happened? Where does my growth happen? And I realised it was only when I had a difficult time or difficult relationship or was upset, that's when I was able to kind of pivot and learn. Not immediately, because it takes time. But and that's where resilience comes in, right? Resilience is your ability to bounce back from adversity, and, you know, get yourself back on track after life throws you off course. And so it's weird when I hear about people who have tough times, and I hear, you know, sad to hear about your tough times, but also it makes me feel excited about the possibilities of what will now happen now that your focus is different, right? And life is much more, you know, open to you, and you probably, your eyes are much more, you know, open to experiences, so it's exciting as
I think
but tough as well.
I think that's what a lot of people contact me, because I wrote a book about divorce, and they said, oh, I'm afraid of what's on the other side. and they know they're miserable and they know they're not happy in the marriage, but somehow the unfamiliar is so scary. And it's like, but what if this, and I can't be a single mum and I can't do this. And it's like, but you know that you're unhappy and you need to face it. And, you know, and I'm guilty of that as well. There's many times I'm sure I felt I should have gone. But yeah, that decision was taken, you know, that into other hands. But, yeah, how do you do that with the work that you do? Like, you know, you can see that there's unhappiness maybe in an organisation or a group of people. What's the best way to start unpacking that?
That's a big question.
Sorry.
How do you start unpacking it? I think, what's my answer to that? I think, I meet people in lots of different ways who are unhappy in some way. They're struggling with something. It could be with a relationship at work. It could be the work that they're doing. So I'm an executive coach. And I did a wonderful coaching course. At the end of the very first day, you have a real person to coach as a guinea pig, and the individual that I coached was a lawyer. It was just on the phone, so I just kind of learnt the skills, but I came on the phone, I had an hour with them to take them through the process, and they said, well, I don't really know what to do with myself, I'm bored, busy, I can't stop, you know, doing things, but I'm really unfulfilled, what on earth do I do? And we had a coaching conversation at the end of it. She was like, oh, you know, thank you very much. That really helped me. And so I suppose what happened there was often it's about giving people the space to think about what's important to them. Because we were talking again about just being on this, on the treadmill of life. Life is busy and we're always focusing outwards. And I think what I do often is create a space for people to think about what's important to them. Not only what's important, but why it's important. So people, you were talking about people who are kind of feel stuck or trapped, and they're worried about what the future might be. So they're holding on to what they know. So what I would do is give them the space to really, you know, dig deeper, I suppose, to find out more about that fear, and help them think about the future and what could it look like if it was different, and take them on the steps. You know, because I think, you know, we can't be happy all the time, but we certainly shouldn't be sad all the time. You know, we shouldn't be feeling fulfilled, we shouldn't be feeling trapped, but we can fall into a default of that because it's what we know, it's what's familiar, and it can feel too tough and too painful to change. But I guess I would argue that, you know, it's too tough and too painful to stay, really.
That's good to flip it.
So just going back to this idea of kids and happiness and stuff like that, and so one thing I think a lot of us struggle with is discipline in that regard, because we do innately want our children to be happy all the time, because we love them, but also part of parenting is saying no, and sometimes saying no makes them unhappy, whether no to the third packet of crisps, or no to the screen time or whatever. So what are some strategies that we can use to help us navigate that?
It's a really good point. And in the book, it talks about the way in which many of us don't want to say no because we are people pleasers. We want to please our children. We want to make them happy. So that the idea, and that's often because of our own childhoods. For those of us who struggle with that, it's often linked to our own childhood, where we maybe had parents or caregivers who were quite strict with us. Therefore, some bit of a coping strategy to please our parents in order to survive, and we kind of fall into that pattern. So that the question really, or the thing to ask yourself, is why is it important not to please the child in that moment? Because we can think about why we want to make them happy, but actually, why is it important that we shouldn't give them that packet of crisps? Not just the second or third, not just in that moment, but in the longer term. What is it that we want to teach them? What are the lessons that we want them to be prepared for in the world? And I struggle with this myself. You know, I want to make my children happy. I want to give them things. I want to say yes. So I have two daughters, mentioned 16 and 12. And my 16-year-old, I've stopped giving pocket money to. Even though I give it to my 12-year-old, because I want her to work. You know, I worked when I was 15. I had a Saturday job in Woolworths. I worked in Miss Selfridge's.
I had a Saturday job when I was 16 in Sainsbury's. Oh my God, we can't
kindred spirits. Tracy, we're kindred spirits.
This is a beautiful thing to watch, ladies.
But I think it's important for, you know, to learn the value of money. And yes, she's not going to earn much, but the alternative is that I just hand her money all the time. Mm. And she takes it for granted, you know, spends willy-nilly. And I mean, I'm not wealthy, you know, by any means, but and I need her to know that when I have money that I give to her, I have to work for it. Therefore, she is now in a position to do the same. So, and I feel bad because I want her to have money. I want her to buy things. I want her to go out. But so in fact, she's looking for jobs this week, which is last week. So she hasn't found one yet. But yeah. So the question is, why is it important not to please that child in the moment? Mm. And it's often more of a longer term goal rather than what's happening in the short term. Mm. So it means that kind of deferred satisfaction or deferred reward for them.
But then how do you explain that to a child in a way that they can understand? Obviously, bearing in mind that children often find it difficult to see the longer term and just think we're being assholes.
So one of the things I think that can be really helpful is to recognise and acknowledge the emotions that the child is experiencing in that moment, and with adults too. So to acknowledge and say, you know, I can see that you're really, I can see that you're upset, and I know how important this is to you, and I know how much you want it, but I can't give this to you right now. You know, maybe tomorrow you can have another, or next week you can have another, but right now, but you know, it's not good for you. You've already had one. You've had a packet of crisps. They tasted yummy. You know, I know you enjoy it. There will be more, but for today, that's all there is. Because mummy knows best, you know, I am much older than you. I know best.
And I want some of the goddamn crisps.
Oh, exactly right.
They're all gone.
Yeah. But I think some children think that there's an unlimited amount of, you know, screen time and money and all that sort of stuff. And I think having some boundaries is really, really important.
Well, we enable that though, don't we?
Yeah.
We give them the unlimited screen time. We give them now that, you know, we've got the 24 packets of crisps or whatever. There is the volume and scale.
Plenty, yeah.
It's surplus. It's excess. Mm. We live in a world of excess, and I mean, I'm older than you ladies are, I'm sure. But you know, when I was growing up, things were much more restrictive, and that was okay. You know, you didn't expect to have things on a repetitive basis regularly. And I think, but because we now have, we give, and that doesn't, and it's, you know, just because we can doesn't mean that we should, because we're not preparing them for life, really.
Oh no. And the way the kids go, oh, we'll just take an Uber, or we'll just get a Deliveroo, I think, god no, all right, yeah. I've got to the immediacy. And like, I just think about telly. Like, if we wanted to watch our favourite show, we had to wait like 5 days, or go down to Blockbuster and rent a VHS. Like, it's not like, I've got 87 choices. Like, that must be very overwhelming for them as well, because then you get that thing where you can't choose anything because it's just too much.
Well, it's in the book, actually. I'm trying to think which lesson it was. I think it spoke about love, right? I think it's the lesson in love, which is chapter 2. And one of the lessons in love talks about the different ways in which we can love our children.
Mm.
And part of that is attunement. Attunement meaning kind of coming down to their level and seeing the world through their eyes. And when we do that, it's exactly what you have said. The world is a really overwhelming place because there is so much of everything. You know, take an Uber. Yeah, let's, you know, we've got 250 channels, plus we've got Netflix and Disney Plus and Amazon Prime, but there's nothing to watch. There is so much of everything. So it's about really trying to see the world through their eyes and help them to navigate and narrow things down and put things into perspective.
Mm.
And that's a way of loving, not just giving them everything all the time.
Because the temptation for me often with that is I hear myself saying in my head, when I was your age, we only had 4 television channels and, you know, and I do struggle with things like that because there are only 4 TV channels, I ended up watching a lot of stuff that I wouldn't normally watch. And I watched a lot of stuff with my parents because we had one box that showed a thing. And whereas my kids are totally used to this world where they can watch literally anything. I mean, not Squid Game, but they can watch like anything. They have a huge choice and they don't want to watch the same sort of stuff that I want to watch all of the time. So I mean, what's the solution to that? Do we just go Victorian and just go, right, we're only watching four channels, I'm going to make you watch this show with me, or, you know, stuff like that? Or do we just accept that that's the world we're living in now? How do you manage all that?
I think the first step is that self-awareness, and you recognise that the way in which your children, our children, are being reared is so different to how we were being reared, and also quite alien as well. In reality, you know, when we were growing up, probably we were mostly influenced by our caregivers, and then maybe our friends, maybe, you know, television or radio or whatever, last of all. But I would say for the most part, children probably are now reared to a large extent by social media or the internet, by anyone and everyone. So how do they obtain their, I was going to say moral compass, but that sounds a bit strong, but how do they retain where do their value set come from if it's not from us? And I think if we think that our children are being too heavily influenced by external sources that we have no control over, then we can, of course, we have control, we have the ability to redress that, to find a balance that feels right. And yes, maybe they won't want to watch, you know, everyone sitting around the television watching Dynasty or whatever, as I used to do with my parents on Friday night, you know.
Beautiful.
They might not want to do that, but I think there are things that we can do, whether it's screen, we used to do screen-free Sundays, don't do it all the time, but screen-free Sundays where we kind of, yeah, we're going to be in a space together doing things, whether it's reading or sitting or board games, implementing that. But even as a parent, it's hard to do that because we're so addicted to our phones. But I think we can certainly put small measures in place to redress that and to find that balance, so that we are rearing our children in a way that feels right for us and not leaving it to all these other external influences to raise them.
Yeah, and it is really easy, especially when you're like, oh, I've got three loads of washing and I'm just going to get all this done, and you're like, well, and you know they're going to be fine, they're just sitting there and they're not going to run off or anything, but then you're like, it is hard when you're balancing your own needs and the lists and all that sort of stuff about, you know, how much screen time you have. But you do feel that ick. Yeah. You know in your guts when they've had too much time you've had a disconnect.
Well, especially if I know I'm not doing laundry and I'm not doing work. I am looking at Instagram, or I am, you know, playing a video game, or I'm doing something that is...
Yeah.
Let's not pretend that every minute they're watching screen time, we're sitting there writing a novel, playing the cello ourselves.
No. That's absolutely true. Or we've snuck upstairs for, you know, 20-minute power nap. Because
is that what you're calling it these days?
All right, 10 minutes. All right.
Depends if the batteries are running.
I think that that we are all slowly becoming technology addicts, really,
because it's such
a habit. It's you know, it's habitual. So we're looking and we're seeking that kind of dopamine hit, that reward. You know, we're searching for something that's going to kind of give us this good feeling inside. And we do it ourselves as adults, and our poor children are doing it as well. You know, so we have to find ways to break that, because it's just a habit.
Yeah, my 10-year-old says to me quite a lot, "Well, you're on your phone all the time," and I struggle to argue with that. I'm like, well. Yeah, and sometimes it's for work, but sometimes it's just browsing. Not. And it's so, I mean, how do we do that? Like you say, if we accept that screens are addictive, I mean, what are the rules in your house? Do you limit it? Do you get them to manage it? Is it a reward thing, or how does it work?
Well, they're 16 and 12. We give them screen time. So, I mean, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work.
Right.
Because kids are so smart nowadays, they know how to get around it. But yes, I mean, I've set my youngest daughter today, they're on half term, so she's not allowed, her phone won't really activate till 1 o'clock this afternoon. So in theory, she should be doing other things rather than looking at her phone.
But so you have a setting on the phone. So
it's a setting on the phone, amazing, which controls when they can access their apps.
Yeah, I have the same as well.
But she hasn't called me. I popped out this, I'm here. Mm. She hasn't called me to say, "Mum, you've put my screen time on," which I know means that she's found a way around it. And she's probably just, I don't know, using another device to access YouTube or whatever she's looking at. But we do try to limit it. And if we go out for meals and things, you know, we always say, you know, put your phone down, or if we're eating, you know, there are certain times where it's absolutely no phone, even though it's hard for them. or if my phone beeps because of a work email and I pick it up straight away, they're on their phone, you know, so it's trying to introduce
they'll see a weakness, exactly right.
A window of hypocrisy to fling open.
It's interesting what you're saying about finding TV shows, because I know Ellie and I have both talked about we've found my kids and I love Parks and Recreation and Modern Family and Brooklyn Nine-Nine. I know your kids like Gordon Ramsay.
We like a bit of
Actually, we love that.
The other week we were on holiday and Joe was going, and I was trying to get them ready to get, you know, get to the beach. I was like, come on guys, put your towels in there. And Joe started going, how long on that squid? How long on that squid? Yeah, I'm going to need that risotto. So it's possibly a sign they've been watching too much, but it wasn't swearing like Gordon fucking Ramsay this
week.
So, yes.
Well, they're learning about food, that's good. But I think that's some of my nicest experiences with my children. And, like, we love these characters. And, like, it was Matilda's birthday the other night, and we had 24 hours in London. And so we were like, we went to out for her favourite pizza and we stayed in a hotel, even though the hotel's half an hour from my house. But we're like, oh, we just watched Brooklyn Nine-Nine together and then just went to all our sort of favourite places together. And that was really nice. Like, there was very little time, apart from watching a bit of telly in the hotel. Yeah. But it was just about us as a little family of three doing all our favourite things together. And I tried not, the only time I got my phone out was to take photos to, to record the memory of it. And it was just really lovely. And I thought, God, I just need to do it. Shouldn't have to be a birthday or something like that for us to have that kind of connection, but it was really good, but anyway, sorry. Saying I'm a lovely parent some of the time.
Well, it's that human contact, isn't it? You know, nothing beats it. You know that, yes, there's artificial intelligence is on the rise, and we've got gadgets, and there's so many things to occupy us social media wise. But just having that human contact, nothing beats it. And giving your child all children want is time. Really, that's all they want. They want you to be looking at them in their eyes. They want attention. They want validation. They want comfort. And if we're looking at our phones and we're not giving that to them, so I can imagine that your daughter, and is it your daughter, she probably had one of the best times because you were just completely focused and devoted and engaged in that experience. So that's what they want.
Well, that and the iPad in my experience. But it is that thing of saying no, because screen makes my kids really happy, especially my eldest kids. I've got two boys. And one of them, he likes screen, like I would say every child I've ever met, but he likes it, but he can disengage from it quite easily. And like sometimes if we have a thing on the telly, he'll go and we'll start drawing or, doing something else. The other child just, it's all he really wants to do. You know, he will, if you take him away, which we do all the time, he will read or he will do something else, but only after he spent 10 minutes moping around going, it is really tough. So, And saying it's hard to say no to the thing that he loves doing. But then one of the things that I think it says in the book that really stuck with me, which I think is, it felt like quite a bold thing to read, maybe it's not, I don't know. It said, we should give our child an early gentle taste of how much unhappiness and resignation all halfway decent lives exact. And I was like, oh my God, that's really dark. But it's true, isn't it? We're all going to get... We're not going to get the job, or we're going to get dumped by the person, or we're going to... Or someone's going to die.
That's right. I mean, and they've had those experiences from when they were very, very small, going to nursery, not being able to play with the toy that they wanted, or, their drink being finished and wanting more, but it's not there. You know, there are going to be, there's going to... A fulfilled life still has disappointment and frustration and regret. So not embracing that, but recognizing that that's just a normal part of life. And going back to the good enough parent, is there to prepare the child and let them, and to let them be in that moment if they are frustrated, to acknowledge, life is frustrating sometimes, and it's okay to be frustrated, it's normal, but not always to be frustrated, and actually the frustration usually doesn't last that long. There's always something else to move on to. So it's about balance, isn't it, as well?
Balance, mate.
Balance, misery, happiness. Screens, not screens.
Yeah.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And another thing I thought was really bold that I wanted to talk about was quite early on in the book. It says we should accept that perhaps we should get rid of this idea that having children is the only path to fulfillment and is an obligatory role for every human on the planet. And if you don't do it, you're somehow missing it.
Yes.
I wanted to read this thing. A society that properly loved children would know that the greatest factor contributing to children's welfare is the removal of the idea that everyone should automatically have them. A good society would give equal prestige to child-free and child-full states. And I was like, yes. Wow, man.
I know, and that's on page, is that look on page
11?
11,
yeah.
I know, it kind of hits you straight away, right, to think about that. And I think when I read that, I was really shocked, actually.
Mm.
But also, I felt comforted and thinking, actually, but it's very real, it's normal. And I have met many women who I think you probably shouldn't have had children, you know, but there is a compulsion or an obligation, a presumption that, you know, all women should, and actually not everybody should, because not everyone really, in order to be a parent, it means compromise, it means giving, it means sacrifice, and not everybody wants to do that or feels the need to do that
or has the capacity because of their own upbringing,
well,
or whatever,
that's
right?
It, that's it, right? So I think, you know, just that's why I think this book is a really powerful book, not just for those who have children, but for you to think about how you were parented, and also for those who don't have children to think about, well, you know, this, you know, these are the things that, these are the reasons why maybe I you know, didn't want to or shouldn't or couldn't, because not everyone should, absolutely, or has to.
Mm.
But there are huge pressures on women to perform and to behave in, you know, to maintain societal standards, and that often is, you know, being this perfect parent.
Yeah, because it's too much for some people. They don't have the capacity for that. And also, it is a fucking hard job. It's a really hard job. Yeah. And there are, you know, days where you think, God, it'd be easier if I didn't have to, you know, spin so many plates and do that sort of thing. But, you know, I adore being a mother. And it's been one of the best things I've ever done in my life and continues to give me a lot of joy. And I love my children so much right now. I don't know how the love, you know, you can't put a quantum, you know, a value on it, but the fact that they're 10 and 13 is a lovely, lovely, lovely age. It's not too complicated yet.
But
I'm not fearing the teenage years so much, because they still communicate with me.
Yeah.
And I think that would be one of my greatest fears as a parent, when they stop telling me how they feel.
Well, can I tell you, please prepare yourself.
Get ready.
All right. It might happen. And if it happens, it's not their fault. You know, it's not their fault. It's very, very normal for teenagers to be moody and unhappy and, you know, can't stand their mother, particularly, you know, just, you know, you're an embarrassment and they shut off and they're closed. Sadly, it's very normal.
Mm.
And I when it happened to me, I wasn't expecting it, but I knew others that it had happened to, and I thought, all right, so this is what they were talking about. And it takes an adjustment, but it's normal. It's normal for 13 to through to 20 to be moody and frustrated and lacking empathy and there's a lot of that. So if it happens, it's not you, it's them, and they're adjusting to, well, number one, they've got so many hormones racing around in them as they kind of transition into adulthood.
Yeah.
And it's usually a temporary thing as well. It's not a permanent state of being. So
if, or as you appear to be saying, when it happens, Tracy, what do you do? Do you just go, okay, I'm just going to trust that this is temporary and it's a phase and I'm just going to hang on in here and give them space and kind of not withdraw, but, you know, not push it.
Yeah.
Or do you fight? Do you kind of go, no, I am going to try and get them to open up and try and get them to talk to me?
Well, I think that the natural inclination is to fight, because it's very frustrating when this wonderful person that you carried and raised is now almost turning against you and being quite defiant or difficult. So you want to face into it, you want them to talk to you, but actually trying to force someone to talk is close to impossible. In my work as a mediator, I learned a lot about how do you create an environment for someone to open up and to build rapport and build trust with them quite quickly. We learnt the skills and techniques, but this was really reinforced by two of my colleagues at CEDA, who used to be hostage negotiators. In fact, one of them used to teach hostage negotiators how to be a hostage negotiator.
Excellent training for teenagers. Yes, excellent good.
Training. And the number one skill that is used to deal with that extreme level of conflict, whether it's, you know, stopping, you know, how do you stop someone from hurting themselves or others, jump off a building, whatever it might be, the number one skill is actually listening, which means trying to find out what's going on for that person. It's not talking, but it's really showing the person that you see them, you hear them, and you want to understand more. So using active listening skills such as paraphrasing, so using your own words based on what they've said, reflecting back either a word that they have said or an emotion. So it might be, okay, so you say you're fine, but when I look at you, you don't look fine. I think you look quite sad. You know, what's happening there? Using open questions, using silence. That is the skill that is used to try to really step into their world and understand as much as possible from them. So it's listening rather than asking questions is the way forward. Now, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. But if you are at least creating that space to try to understand, seeking to understand, in Stephen Covey's book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, habit number 5 is seek first to understand, then to be understood. If you're at least trying to step into their space, show them that you're with them, even if you don't agree, then it makes them much more likely to think at least you understand them to an extent, rather than trying to force something that they're not ready to give. So what I do is I try to actively listen, to show them, to kind of, you know, stay on their path, understand their thoughts as fully as possible, instead of just always giving my defence or rebuttal or, you know, my opposite view.
Or hit my husband's favourite, I know what you should do.
No, I don't want you to tell me what to do. No. I just want you to listen to me moaning.
Yeah. Why is that so hard?
Yeah. Yeah.
He's upstairs, actually, Tracy. Do you mind if I get him down? We'll have a quick sesh.
Got
have
Tracy a quick in. She'll sort you out.
Yeah. Oh, well, there we go. Yeah, well, what a great book. I also like, just in chapter 7, Lessons in Naughtiness, there's this bit about family 1 and family 2 that I just wanted to talk about, where it says in family 1, the child is well behaved. They say how nice the food is. They talk about what happened at school. They listen to what their parents have on their minds, and then they go and finish their homework, which is what we're all supposed to do, right? Yes. That's what we're all striving for, or at least told to strive for it.
Yes.
In family 2, things are different. The child calls their mother an idiot. They snort with derision when the dad says something. They make a rude comment. If the parents ask how their homework is going, they say school is stupid and they storm off and slam the door. I mean, obviously I'm family 1 in that scenario. Yeah. Tracy, I can't speak for you two. But it says it looks as if everything is going one in family 1 and bad in 2.
Yeah.
But if you look inside the child's mind,
you might get a different picture.
Yes, yeah. Please. Yes,
so what
please.
Is actually going on in those two families?
Yeah, well, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, family one, when you listen to it, family one, they're very obedient and they're, you know, playing the role of being very nice. It's clear that there are much more restrictions on what is safe and what is not safe. But family two, which is quite, I think it's a bit extreme, hopefully, in comparison to mine, although I think I'm a little bit more family two. Family two is giving people the space to be free and to be themselves and to be honest and have those honest conversations and reveal their emotions and be truthful about what they're experiencing, knowing that they're not going to offend because it's a safe environment. There is a safe base where family, the children and family two can express themselves. So the result of that is that the family one, where the child is perhaps very obedient and accommodating and hasn't quite learnt the language and the nuances and the vocabulary to say when they're frustrated or they're upset, etc., is more likely to be less equipped to have those conversations as an adult, because of course we carry our methods of being and our ways of being from childhood into adulthood, whereas in the child and family too, that can be expressive and that can be very honest, perhaps too honest at times, is someone that can be more likely to actually get what they want because they can articulate that, knowing that they're actually going to be okay even if they tell mum that, you know, you're really annoying. And it's, yeah, they're much more likely to be someone who essentially is going to be more emotionally intelligent, to be fair, because they know how to manage their emotions. I did have an incident. I had a little incident last week with my youngest daughter. She was getting ready for school. It was the week before last, and she couldn't find her skorts in the morning. So there was a lot of drama in the house, a lot of tension. And I was like, you know, how many times do I have to tell you? Organise yourself the night before, then you'll be fine. And she was like, really, she was quite moody and upset. And she didn't say goodbye, which is very unusual for her. So she left, and then she left the house in the morning, and she called me on the way to school, and she said, "Oh, Mum, I just wanted to say I'm really sorry for being rude." And I said, "Okay, you know, what do you think you were rude about?" She said, "Well, you know, I wasn't really listening to you, and I was moody, and I didn't say goodbye, and I thought, you know, that's not how I should be with you, so I'm just really sorry about that." I said, "It's all right, Jazzy, you know, it's fine to do that." I said, "To be honest, we can all be rude sometimes, can't we? We can all be grumpy, we can all be frustrated, so it's absolutely fine, it happens to all of us." And in that moment, I felt really pleased that I'd read the book, and really proud that she was able to express herself, and I kind of let her express herself, but also, thankfully, she was emotionally intelligent enough to recognise that's not really how I want to be. So yes, giving the children the freedom to be expressive but respectful as well, you don't want it to be too extreme, is important in order for them to grow up to be well-rounded, I think.
So there you go, in a nutshell, if your child's calling you a dickhead, you're doing it all right. It's all, you're a great parent, well done, you're good enough.
Absolutely.
Oh, lovely stuff.
I didn't say that.
No, but I'm paraphrasing it for you. That's my
such
unique
active
skill.
Listening.
Yeah. I'm actively listening, and now I'm hearing what I want to hear. And stuff. Well, gosh, I feel illuminated, Helen.
I do too. I feel like I'm going to be a better mother from now on.
Forever. Yeah, absolutely. Flawless.
Absolutely done.
Speaking of poor parenting, shall we have a scummy mummy confession?
Yes. Would you like me to go first?
Oh, go on.
So on the 24 hours of Matilda, we went to a place called Snog, which is our favourite frozen yogurt place, and we went to the one that's in Soho. Okay, and it just happens to be opposite a sex shop.
Lovely.
Which is nice for the kids. Mm. And so we were in there and ordering our frozen yogurt, and we looked across.
Oh, God, I thought you were in the sex shop. Jesus.
No. So we're in the frozen yogurt, and the kids turned over, and the door was open to the sex shop, and it was just like a wall of dildos, and they'll go, dildos. Anyway, next thing I know, Martin Freeman walks in, who is the Hobbit.
Oh, off of, Sherlock.
So really famous. So we were like literally all clutching our knees going...
Did you say Mark Freeman or Martin?
Martin Freeman. Okay. Yeah. Sherlock and their favourite film, Nativity.
Wow.
Anyway, I thought this was really funny. After he left, I went, "Hey kids, dildo baggins." And then... then we were in bits, yeah. Absolute bits. That's a Hobbit franchise.
Surely you followed up with, he could be the Lord of my rings anytime he likes.
I know. And then I was like, I'm being such a tart for a laugh. I've just spent 24 hours with my children, and now I'm trying to do like funny puns about sex toys. And they kept going to me throughout the weekend. Hey, Mum. Dildo Baggins. Anyway, terrible, but we bonded. Anyway, yes. There's a lot in that story.
Elementary, my dear Coxon. That's a lovely story. Yeah. I'm trying to think. So my confession is, so we just went on holiday for half term. We went to Italy. Yes, it was very nice. Thank you.
Awesome.
And it was, we had some days with some lovely weather, so we were able to go in the sea. But it was that kind of like, where like, it takes a little bit of effort to get in. And yeah. Once you're out, you don't necessarily want to get straight back in.
You probably feel very good that you've done it, though.
It wasn't that warm. So, yes. And so we'd got out. So we'd had a little swim. We got out the sea. And then, so here's the thing. So we do a stage show. We have a joke in our stage show that's based on a real confession, because we get the audience to write down Scummy Mummy confessions. And one of them wrote that she was in the pool with a load of kids. It was the 80s when you could take a lot of kids in on your own. Not really safe. It was a different time. And one of the kids said, I really need a wee. And she said, oh, just do it in the pool. And then the kid got out of the pool and did it standing on the edge of the pool, like with his little trunks down. Mm. So I now have stolen this, because this is the sort of thing I mean. You can't write that shit, no, Tracy. That's fucking great. So I've nicked that for my own stand-up, and now I tell that on stage as if it's my story. When, of course, in reality, I would never teach my children to piss in a swimming pool. But then anyway, so then we got out of the sea the other day, and we were like, oh, just getting dry. And then I looked over and I was like, oh, look, there's Charlie just looking out to sea. No, he wasn't looking out to sea. He was pissing in the sea from the shoreline. Luckily, the beach was quite empty.
They could have done while it's in them.
They could have done it. Yeah.
Cock in the wind. Lovely.
So, because I'm a great mum, I took a picture and I sent it to Helen.
Yeah.
Because not front
view. Back view. It did look like he was just having a whimsical look out to the Italian sea. But
so
no.
That's my lovely story.
Nice.
Tracy, do you have a Scummy Mummy confession for us? Do you
have nothing like your confession.
No, I mean, we set the bar very low. sorry.
Something I feel a little bit guilty about. On the weekend, I was talking to my husband about our youngest daughter, Jasmine, and she loves life. She's really smart. You know, she loves sports. She loves everything. And she really loves drama, and she's recently started to go to a local drama group, a theatre group, on a Friday and a Sunday, and she goes to Brit Kids on a Saturday, so she just loves drama and theatre. But on Friday evening, she'd been invited to a Halloween party. So I was talking to my husband, and I said, oh, you know, do you think she wants to go to the Halloween party, or does she really want to go to the theatre group? Now, we had told the theatre group was actually closed for half term, so that's why she felt comfortable going to the Halloween party. Mm-hmm. And I said that if the theatre group was still open, she'd probably want to go to that instead. And he said, oh, I don't know. So I said, oh, why don't we tell her that the theatre group, they didn't close for half term, they're actually open tonight, and therefore she has to choose between going to the Halloween party or the theatre group, which she loves. So I called her downstairs and said, oh, Jasmine, I said, actually, I've just received an email. Have you seen it? Your theatre group's open tonight, but it's at the same time as your Halloween party. I'm really sorry. You know, what are you going to do? And she was like, are you kidding me? She goes, are you sure it's on tonight? Are you sure, Mum? Because that wasn't the case. And what time does it start and what time does it finish? Because maybe I can just go to the party afterwards. I said, well, no, you can't do both. You've got to choose. Oh, well, I need to think about it. I need time to think about it. I said, oh, no, you need to kind of decide now at like 12 o'clock in the afternoon. And she was like, oh, and then she was umming and ahhing. And in the end, she said, well, all right, then I'll just go to the Halloween party, because the theatre group's on every week and the Halloween party's only on once a year. Mm. I said, all right, then, well, you know, fair enough. And I lost the bet, which was to buy my husband sushi. And we told her, and she was like, how could you do that to me? I'm 12 years old.
She's
so
smart.
So I felt really bad about it. But yeah, that's a confession, I think. That's as bad as it gets.
Oh, I love it. I love it. See, not even Tracy Fox is perfect parent.
No,
we're all just bloody good enough. She's a scummy mummy like the rest of us. Lovely
stuff. Is.
Oh, well, there we go. Well, thank you so much, Tracy, for all your wisdom, man.
Absolutely brilliant. And where can people find the School of Life? Because that is a, you've got websites and all sorts of things.
Yeah, we're everywhere, you know, so you can go to theschooloflife.com. We've got masses and masses of content on the YouTube channel. If you go to our website, we've got lots of books and literature. You can log into classes and workshops and events. So yeah, there's just lots to keep you occupied and help you, you know, help you, you know, continue to learn how to live and live a fulfilled life.
And the book is called The Good Enough Parent, and it's a nice handbag size of putting in the toilet. That's
you can skip through it in a night, actually. It's a really but also just a lovely resource. You just go, oh yeah, what did they say about this and whatever. But I, as you said, like the way in which Alain did, can you say how do you say his name?
Alain de Botton.
Alain de Botton. It is a very gentle, like, no, you're okay. It doesn't feel patronising or absolutely, like, no, they're fucked. No, it's like, you're going to be all right.
Yeah, that's the sequel. No, you fucked it up. You weren't good enough. That's the book too.
Yeah, you're ruined now. Yeah.
And where can people, if people want more Tracy Fox, where can they find you, Tracy?
So I've got a website, tracyfox.co.uk. It's a terrible website, I have to say. But yeah, I'm on there. I'm on LinkedIn, or I'm on the School of Life website, or I work for CEDA, the Centre for Effective Dispute Resolution, as well, when it comes to mediation. So yeah, I'm everywhere.
Excellent, excellent.
Yeah. Awesome. And where are we, Ellie Gibson?
We're all over the shop, mate, both literally and figuratively. Yes, we're on tour. We're going on tour. We're all over the place. So go to scummymummies.com for live show dates and tickets. We're booking new ones and putting them up there for next year all the time now. So keep an eye on that. Sign up for our newsletter if you like. If you go to scummymummieshop.com, you can sign up for our newsletter. Not that we ever hardly send them out. But it's on the list.
It is.
It's on the list.
And yes, we're going to Norwich and Cambridge, because people keep asking about that. And we're doing two nights in Norwich and two nights in Cambridge. So I think they'll be on sale very soon. So exciting times.
Yes. I think that's everything, is it?
It is. What a delight you've been, Tracy. Oh, and enlightening.
Yes.
Delightful and enlightening.
Oh, delightening.
Yeah, delightening.
Yes. thank you for listening, everybody.
Thank you for having me.
Aww, until next time.
Bye-bye.
In my work as
that's great. That's the old drilling. Don't know if the mic's picking it up.
Let me. Okay, yeah.
He stopped. Oh well.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.